House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 692. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, Senate Bill 692A defines key terms, establishes minimum energy efficiency standards for televisions, large battery charger systems, inductive charger systems, and small battery charger systems, with certain exceptions effective January 1st, 2014. Prohibits a person from selling, offering to sell, or installing for compensation a television, large battery charger system, inductive charger system, or small battery charger system, unless the energy efficiency of the new product meets or exceeds the standards specified in the Act effective January 1st, 2014. It establishes a minimum energy efficiency standards for lavatory faucets, water closets, dual flush tank type water closets, urinals, floor mounted urinals, and high light output double ended quartz halogen lamps effective January 1st, 2016. Prohibits a person from selling, offering to sell, or installing for compensation lavatory faucets, water closets, dual flush tank type water closets, urinals, floor mounted urinals, and high light output double ended quartz halogen lamps unless the energy efficiency of the new product meets or exceeds standards specified in the Act effective January 1st, 2016.
Okay. Senator Dingfelder, pleased to welcome our chair counterpart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And actually, you know, because I anticipate that you're going to comment on both these bills today, I'm going to go ahead and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 840 as well.
You read my mind, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you for hearing these bills today. I'm State Senator Jackie Dingfelder from Senate District 23, Northeast, Southeast Portland, and Maywood Park. So I am bringing forth to you, or came over from the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, I think in a unanimous vote, a bill that actually, for those of you who have been around, at Representative Boone, because there's not that many old-timers up here. It's a lot of new.
Careful now. I don't know if that kind of language flies in the Senate, but
the two of us are definitely old-timers.
Been around a while.
Thank you for that remark. But
and so this is going to look familiar to Representative Boone, because this is actually the fourth time that we are doing this. So Oregon, as you may know, is a national leader on energy efficiency standards, and Senate Bill 692A is the next step in the long line of Oregon efficiency standards. This is the fourth time that this legislative body has deliberated on a bill like this that forwards the strengthening of energy efficiency standards, each bill passing with broad bipartisan support. I actually think the first time I worked on this, or the first and second times, it was in the minority. The bills save Oregonians millions of dollars annually in reduced energy costs. Oregon's next generation of low-cost, high-benefit measures will save energy, reduce water use, and save consumers even more on their utility bills. Senate Bill 692 aligns efficiency standards already in effect in California. Because California represents such a large market, it makes sense to align our standards with those in our neighboring states. It's also important, and you may ask, so why do we need this bill? It's also important that Oregon not become the dumping ground for inefficient appliances. And this came up the first time that I worked on this bill, when California was ahead of the standards. And we looked at that and said, well, yeah, you know, but things are going to change because of California. And then it became pretty clear to us that we didn't want some of these inefficient appliances being sold here because they were not set at the same standards. So that's one of the reasons that we are looking at this for the fourth time, because we want to make sure that Oregon doesn't become a dumping ground for inefficient appliances that can no longer be sold in California. So what does Senate Bill 692A do? It expands efficiency standards for four appliance types to the state's existing efficiency standards. The four types in the bill are as follows. Vampire battery chargers, and if you haven't heard that term, these are they basically are chargers that suck up energy, and you don't really know it. But if you're leaving an appliance on overnight to charge, fortunately, it uses quite a bit of electricity. Many folks aren't aware of that. And so this, and it can waste up to 60% of electricity that they consume. So this standard alone is projected to save consumers $15.7 million in annual electricity costs by 2020. Small battery chargers for consumer electronic devices, as well as large battery chargers for forklifts, golf carts, and these will be required to meet efficiency standards already in place in California. Senate Bill 692A also requires one type of common outdoor floodlights, double-ended quartz halogen lamps to be more energy efficient. Improving efficiency on this one type of bulb, mainly used for parking lots and street lighting, will save about $5 million in annual electricity costs by 2020. Requiring new plumbing products, toilets, urinals, and faucets sold in Oregon to use less water. By 2020, these standards will save $5.2 million in annual consumer water bills and save half a billion gallons of water. And as Representative Bentz knows, that's a lot of water. These plumbing products, product standards are already in place in Texas, California, and Georgia. They conserve water resources, reduce energy used to pump and treat water and wastewater, and more importantly, these more efficient products cost the same as the older, less efficient versions. Also, by 2025, Senate Bill 692A will save more than half a billion gallons of water and deliver $25 million in annual utility bill savings to Oregon's families, businesses, schools, and other members of the public. So we worked, the reason that you see an A on this bill is because we worked diligently with industry partners in the Senate. We had multiple work group meetings to address some of the concerns that were raised. It passed, as I mentioned, out of the Senate Environment Committee unanimously and on the Senate floor with the bipartisan support. And then this other bill, you're probably wondering, well, why do we have a separate bill for plumbing? I know I'm reading
this my mind.
Over Sorry. Your head, Mr. Chair, because we inadvertently, I should say we in the collective sense with legislative counsel, crafted a bill with a relating clause that was too narrow, so we could not make some of the changes to the plumbing fixtures that we had intended to. So this is now a partner bill that establishes the limits on the average amount of water for specified plumbing fixtures. The other good thing that came out of this bill is that we strengthened our communications between the Oregon Department of Energy and DCBS, and you will see Mark Long, the director, sitting behind me. I've worked with Mr. Long for many, many years on water reuse standards. On waterless urinals, we have a long history that anyone ever wants to go have a couple beers over. But we have made great strides in our plumbing code.
Aren't you the leader of the Craft Brewers Caucus?
I'm not touching that one.
Okay. Yeah. We can create a new caucus representative.
Is that our stage urinal?
Yes, the waterless urinal and microbrew. But so we have made great strides, but obviously we have some more work to be done. But one of the things that is really important is that we are working collaboratively with the folks who are installing these products on the ground, and that's something that I appreciate the work of DCBS is making sure that we comport with Oregon's plumbing codes, because we don't want to be asking our plumbers and electricians, but in this case the plumbers, to be installing products that aren't available or don't work for our building standards. So that, in a nutshell, is these two bills. As I mentioned, you'll be hearing more from Mr. Long today, and I appreciate you considering this measure. I'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Senator. And, Senator, could you just touch briefly on, were there any outstanding issues from the Senate side that came up over there and were already addressed or that we need to consider here?
We, as I mentioned, we had a work group. We worked with the realtors. We worked with the lighting folks. We did not have any issues with the TV standards. And then also, as I mentioned, with the plumbing, that was probably where we had, we just needed to make sure that there was consistency with the plumbing code. And as I mentioned, we still need some more tweaks to that particular bill because we were running out of time in the Senate. We wanted to make sure and address all the concerns that we could before the deadline. I made a commitment and said on the record that we'd be happy to work with the plumbing folks over here to make sure that gets fixed.
Thank you.
And I want to thank, there was many folks in sitting behind me that worked on this and really appreciate it. As I said, that we had no opposition in the committee after we addressed all those concerns. Great.
Questions? Representative Whitson.
Will it be illegal to resell appliances that do not meet the standards set forth in Senate Bill 692?
The once these standards are in place, yes. So it says a manufacturer may not sell. And the onus, I should emphasize, the onus has always been on the manufacturer because we want to make it as, let's say, easy as possible for the retailers. One of the things that we did do was extend, if you look at the dates in the bill, the effective dates, we actually extended those to provide a longer period so retailers could sell out their existing stock. That was one of the issues that came forward. But as far as, so we extended that time to make sure that there was adequate time for retailers to get that off their shelf.
Clarification?
I actually said resell. So when you have stores that are reselling appliances, or, for example, some of our Habitat for Humanity that resells our appliances, are they going to be unable to sell these now?
You know, that issue didn't come up. And since the onus is on the manufacturer, I'm not sure. So that's something you probably want to check with LC. There may be, Department of Energy might be able to answer that question. But that issue didn't come up. And actually, I'm not sure it would apply to resale because, again, it's a manufacturer may not sell. So I don't know if Jeff, do you have an answer to that question?
We have a subsequent panel coming up that perhaps can address.
Okay, great.
Would you gentlemen like to come up
now? Yeah, why don't you come up?
Why don't you come up now?
Now I can
call up Charlie Stevens and Justice, and that you were the next panel anyway.
Because I think there was another question.
Okay, yeah. The bill does not apply.
For the record, you could introduce yourself.
Charlie Stevens, Senior Codes and Standards Engineer with the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. The bill only applies to new products. So once they are a used product, none of these regulations actually apply. So there are many products that have already been out there, and you can't govern the efficiency of what's already in service.
So it will not be illegal for somebody to resell either from their home or from a store any plumbing fixtures or any appliances that fall under this, you're saying, on the record?
Right. Just the same as it wouldn't apply to your five-year-old television, it wouldn't apply to your six-month-old television once it had been sold once.
Thank you.
I was going to say, that would have been my guess, but thanks for clarifying. And nobody was smart enough in my committee to ask that question. Sorry.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm looking at 840, the plumbing component of your legislation here. Maybe, I'm just guessing at the reductions in the minimums and so forth for usage of water and the different appliances and stuff. Is this pretty much closely patterned after what California already has enacted? Is that correct?
Really can probably answer that, I was going to say.
These regulations are in place in a number of places in California, mostly municipalities and in Texas so far.
So the state of Texas, is that correct?
Or the state,
municipalities,
yes.
Within
municipalities in California and in the state in Texas.
Okay.
I was going to say, I said it in my original testimony, Texas, California, and Georgia, the plumbing product standards have already been adopted by the states. Yes.
Well, I've been around long enough, as some of you have, to remember when, you know, there really weren't any criteria for the amount per flush at all, and then it's gone down to 1.6, you know, gallons per flush. And obviously, the industry has had to work the kinks out, if you will, over time to ensure that that works. I'm just wondering about what kind of process or what can we point to in terms of trial and error to know whether, regardless of who's adopting them, are they working, and is there
repercussion, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, eventually, how low can you go and still?
1.3 is my understanding right now.
Yeah.
Mr. Bissonnette, can I identify yourself?
Is there any scientific authority that tells you that, in fact, this will, I don't want to say get the job done, but you know what I mean?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Johnson, for the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board representing residential ratepayers. there's a lot in this bill to kind of keep moving, and this is one of the issues. I think just to clarify, so first clarification, then to answer your question directly, Senate Bill 840, as the Senator said, came about because building codes identified some language in their statutes that didn't comport particularly with federal existing federal regulations, and they asked, can we use your bill to take care of that? We said, sure, and that's what didn't fit under the relating clause, and therefore Senate Bill 840 was born to kind of take care of that. As the discussion continued around 692, it became more and more clear that if we dealt with all of the plumbing stuff together under the building codes, that would make a lot more sense. And so our intention here is to offer an amendment to take all of the plumbing standards out of 692 and put them in 840. To answer your question, you know, directly, again, you know, what you see in 840 is federal regulation. What's proposed in Senate Bill 692 that will be coming over to 840 is in place in California and Texas and the states that the senator listed. And very late in the process, we had some municipalities kind of raise an issue about you know, the effect on wastewater systems and that sort of thing. And you know, they acknowledged that it was very late, and we made a commitment to talk about that issue here. We actually have a phone call tomorrow with representatives of municipalities and special districts led by the League of Cities and the Special Districts Association. And so we'll be able to kind of answer that question a little bit more intelligently. I think that they raised some issues rightly, and we'll work through them. And as another lobbyist, not me, is fond of saying, we'll see if the bill passes the smell test. So,
with that, we have a couple more people in the queue. However, I'm cognizant of the fact that both you gentlemen, I believe, have testimony that you wanted to give as well. So, and I'd like to let the senator get back to her other business. I know she's busy. Are there any specific questions for the senator before we take testimony from these two gentlemen?
I guess I'd ask her, if you would, since this is this 840 is the one that you're considering further work or tweaks on, we've run in our construction business, we've run into this too, and then personally at my own house, I have unlimited water, not on a system of, it's my own system, and very low pressure because of how it's structured. But so the very low amount in the toilet doesn't, as he said, get the job done. And so you end up using more, I think, flushing several times. Or in the shower situation, you just have a drip and it doesn't work. And so I'm wondering if you would be amenable to exempting, you know, systems that aren't on the public, aren't on big water, a big water use system.
I was going to say that the issue hadn't come up as far as pressure. I think that's something that, again, you know, as Mr. Bissonnette said, talking to some of the experts, as far as the pressure issue, we didn't hear any that there's any problems with that, and I think there are lots of folks in those states, Texas and Georgia, the rural states. Certainly, I can ask Charlie over here, who's an expert, to see if there's been any problems with the pressurized system, but that's not something that came up as an issue at all.
Charlie Stevens again. I don't know if I'm knowledgeable enough to answer that. I think it's possible that there could be some problems, and I think probably the folks who can discuss this or are planning to discuss this tomorrow might actually cover that ground, and if there are some issues uncovered, it might be well to consider those seriously.
Yeah. So I'd say stay tuned, and maybe we can report back and see what we find out, and certainly we can talk to the plumbing folks as well and see if they know of any issues, their counterparts in the other states where they've been using these standards for a while.
Well, you have a follow-up for the senator.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's a unique situation because it's not a public system, put it that, and there are lots of them in the rural areas. Yeah. So,
thank you for bringing that to our attention. I'm sure we'll be finding out more as we flush this out.
Ooh, I knew she was going to do that.
Parting shot. Representative Wendner, did you have a question specifically for the senator or for a technical issue on the bill?
I'll try to answer as many technical questions on flushing.
This is not technical.
Yeah.
It's actually about flushing if you like using a brush, but Are you okay with keeping these separate as 692 and 840, or do you want them combined? Because there could be some issues on one part that people on this committee may not like on 692, and then there's other parts on 840 that we don't like. Like the one point, I just built an Energy Star house, and I have the 1.3-gallon toilet, and it gets flushed a couple times, and you got to keep a brush handy because I have four boys in the house, so...
As far as the reason what we pulled out the as I said, the water efficiency did not fit under energy efficiency, so that's why we pulled it out. It sounds like most of the work that still needs to be done is on the water side, so I think it's probably easier at this point just to keep them separate, but it sounds like we're going to be doing some more work on the water efficiency.
I think you would have a better chance of actually having something than if we kept them together, so because I think there might be hang-ups amongst different members here.
Yeah. Well, I will let the chair and his
wisdom take that under advisement.
Out, yeah, figure out what he wants to do.
Mr.
Thank
Chair,
you.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
Sorry.
Representative Dunbar.
Can I say no to my own representative? Sorry. To my own representative?
He's a constituent, Senator.
Oh, yeah, that's me.
Actually, this is kind of a more philosophical question, but, you know, as a preface to that, I know that... You will be prepared to answer this, good Senator, since you have a high school in your district that is now the national champion in everything related to things intellectual. But that aside, I do have a sort of philosophical question about, or I don't know if it's philosophical, but the distinction between when issues like this should be resolved in statute and when they should be resolved in rule. And, you know, when you set standards like this, you know, do we put it in legislation or do we allow the rulemaking process to deal with it? Was that something you talked about during the course of, you know, the previous iteration of this?
Thank you for bringing that up, Representative. Yes, it was, and actually it's been a discussion item every time. And right now, that's very true. When you look at that statute and you look at how detailed it is, it's not typically how we write statute. And the way that I like to think about it is statute, we provide the policy direction, and then we leave it to the experts to decide what the standards are through the rulemaking process and the administrative process. So I would say that for whatever reason, the legislature, in their wisdom, and possibly Jeff Bissonnett can provide you a little bit of history, decided that they wanted to set these standards in statute, and that was in 2003 when we first worked on this bill, and I asked the same question. Then I asked it again, and I asked it again, and I asked it this time. But obviously, the legislature and legislators didn't feel confident in providing that authority to the Oregon Department of Energy. Personally, I think that's the way to go because these standards do change on a regular basis. I would prefer not to be coming in front of this committee many times, as I've done in the past, to say, here's what we need to do in statute. That is why we have a regulatory process, because it affords more flexibility while allowing for transparency, because there is obviously a public and a stakeholder process involved with rulemaking, just like there is in making laws. So I think that's what most states do. California certainly does. It gives the authority to, it's the California, what's the board?
Energy Commission.
Energy Commission. And I think that if we in the legislature in their wisdom decides long term, I certainly think that given that the states are leading, I hate to say leading the charge, but leading the charge in many aspects on energy efficiency, that's part of why more flexibility makes sense in the long term. And so I would say that maybe we can come back next session with a bill that says give ODO the authority to do that, working in concert with DCBS.
Senator, you may not be aware, but we have a House rule on this side that when you say, in their wisdom, in relationship to the legislature, you must use air quotes.
Okay.
So just so you know.
There you go, in retrospect.
Yeah.
And by the way, just in case you didn't know, Representative Dembro was alluding to the fact that our high school grant high school...
This is out of order.
not
germane to the bill.
National Constitution team, and my staff was there. So
well, congratulations,
you.
Lincoln Cardinals. Wish you the best, and we'll be back next
they
year.
They were next. Thank you.
Lincoln used to be a good...
Gentlemen, who would like to start?
I will. Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizen Utility Board. Some of my opening remarks are kind of taken up by this initial conversation, which is fine. I think that two things I will mention, and then I will talk specifically about some of Representative Dembro's philosophical issue. As ratepayers, we're always looking to figure out how to save energy through energy efficiency. We like to say the cheapest kilowatt hour is the one that you don't have to produce in the first place. There is a cost to where you acquire those savings. If you acquire them sort of at the utility level, it's still the cheapest resource, but it can be relatively expensive in relation to, say, catching it at the retailer level where it's can be tens of dollars, but then at the manufacturer level, it can be literally single dollars or cents. And so if you can capture that efficiency further up the food chain, and the more you can do that, the better off everybody is. And so that's really what codes and standards allow us to do, is capture those savings very far up in the food chain. As the senator said a few times, this is the fourth time that we've been through a process like this, basically staying in line with California to keep our standards on appliances for energy efficiency in line with theirs. And to speak specifically about Representative Dembro's point, it would make a lot of sense to do that, i.e., adopt these in rules, adopt the policy, and go from there. Early on, when we started doing this a decade ago, the industry wasn't really comfortable with doing that, frankly. They wanted to be sure that what was being adopted were the California standards, because that's what they were building to. If you were adopting them close to California or equal to California, then by and large, they were okay with that. And what they were afraid of was a state adopting the legislative policy and then having a state agency go nuts and adopt a much higher standard, and they wanted to avoid that. That may be changing, and so the time might be getting ripe to have that conversation. One change that we did make in 2007 is we did allow the department, once the legislature adopted standards in policy and in statute, and there were updates, either from California or from from other directions, the State Department of Energy was empowered to keep Oregon standards lined up by rule. And so they can do that. They can update existing standards that the legislature has already adopted by rule. But if we want to look at new standards, we have to do it in legislation, at least right now. With that, I'm going to turn the conversation over to Charlie Stevens, who you've already been introduced to. Charlie has a lot of experience doing that, and even saying that is a gross understatement. He works both regionally on a national level with manufacturers, with other state agencies, and can, if I know you have a lot of members here who like to go deep into details, and Charlie is exactly the guy who can go there with you. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Stevens.
Thank you, Jeff. Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee.
Mr. Stevens, it'll distort a little bit less if you pull back just
up
a bit.
There you go. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you.
As I said, I'm the Senior Codes and Standards Engineer with the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. I've been doing standards, appliance efficiency standards, at the state and federal level since 1990. I've been directly involved in the standards processes that you see before you today for televisions and battery charges for the last 3 years. My organization has also invested heavily in television market transformation over the last several years. And we have pushed the market in the Pacific Northwest substantially beyond Energy Star at this point, in anticipation of achieving some standards for these products. I was involved, as I say, in both the state of California proceedings and in the federal proceedings for both of these products, and I'm still involved because the television test procedure is still in flux. We just, comment period closed on Friday for the most recent proposal. And the reason why this is important to you today is because we don't really know how to accurately measure the energy consumption of televisions just yet. In other words, we can't measure the laboratory test up to the actual use in the field in your home just yet, but we're working on it. We suspect that when that television test procedure is done, that the numbers on the television will go up. But fortunately, we believe that we've invested sufficiently here in the Northwest that it won't affect the consumers here. And we've invested in anticipation of standards, either at the federal level or at the state level. The federal level, US DOE was authorized to set television standards in 1987, and we're still waiting. For battery chargers, that rulemaking is a year and a half behind schedule right now, and they've halted it right now to see if maybe their analysis needs to be upgraded, given that there's nearly 4,000 battery chargers now that are meeting the California standards and certified to the website there. So DOE is thinking maybe the California standards might be the appropriate ones, and we've aligned our standards here in Oregon with those. So if I am technically very deep into the weeds here, and you probably don't want to go there, but if you do, I'm happy to tell you about the market, the Pacific Northwest, the technology, the test procedures, and anything else you need to know about battery chargers and televisions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions for this witness? Representative Bentz, you've been very patient.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm just curious, what does a big screen TV generally cost a family a month for electricity? What's the baseline that we're trying to achieve a savings against?
Well, that depends on which television in the house it is and how many hours a day the family watches. Our data, we have quite a little bit of data in the Northwest, suggests about 5.5 hours of watching per day. It's about a half a kilowatt hour a day for a 40-inch television, plus or minus. Larger for a larger television, less for a smaller television.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
And what's that cost the person?
It's about 5 cents a day.
And so the follow-up. The question is, if we achieved a savings of what type of savings could we hope to achieve by virtue of these higher standards for that nickel a day? How much can we reduce it by half? Can we reduce it by 20%? What are we talking?
Television energy consumption, again, because of our investment in working directly with the manufacturers and the distributors and the large retailers of these products, have come down quite a bit in anticipation of standards. The problem in the future is we don't exactly know what a television may be in the future. The product is actually morphing and taking on new functions. And what a standard does is it creates an energy budget, but the savings add up to millions of dollars a year in electricity costs for consumers because there are so many televisions and they are on for so many hours.
Right, and I was just trying to put into everyday perspective the meaning that this standard has to a normal family. Maybe they have one or two of these screens now in their house.
About 7 hours worth of television watching per day at say 100 watts for an average size television. So again, it's a little more than a half a kilowatt hour a day, but it'll add up to something on the order of 20 kilowatt hours a month.
So I think, Representative, what we're trying to drive towards is, can we make some of these cost savings real on sort of an average family basis? What does this mean for an average family in terms of cost savings over the course of a year?
Probably $20 or so a year. It's much smaller per battery charger than for televisions, but there are 11 of them per household typically. So the problem is not so much the per unit, but how much they use. And the other problem is that the televisions are getting bigger. So this number is going up as the televisions get larger and larger.
Follow-up question on this line. Yeah. The turnaround time for a television now, is it 4 years, 5 years? It seems quicker than it used to be.
It's about 7 years, and the televisions tend to migrate downhill it become, you know, the primary television becomes the secondary television and then later becomes the tertiary television. And so the new one and the biggest one usually goes in the one that's most watched. So they migrate. But they'll be in service for 12 years or longer, typically.
I did have another question.
Please.
Surprisingly. The question is, how much more did the TV cost as a result of the higher energy standard achieved?
Less, actually. The technologies that are used to achieve the efficiency actually cost less per unit. The biggest driver is LED lighting. For the backlighting, we're moving from cold cathode lighting for the backlighting of an LCD TV to LEDs. And the LEDs themselves cost a little more, but the overall process of getting them into the television costs less. So the televisions actually don't cost more.
Right. There's a name for this, but what happens is when you have a TV that's 20 inches by 20 inches, you always upgrade to 40 by 40, and then you go to 60 by 60, and then God knows what's next. But the point is that the savings is usually taken up by facts when you just get a bigger set. So in order to make what you just said real, we'd have to see if indeed those sets are getting bigger, even though the energy is less. So maybe no energy savings at all because you just have a bigger set. So how would we be able to, and there's a name for this, and unfortunately I've forgotten it.
Well, I think we've determined pretty conclusively with all of our market work, some of which, by the way, we just published last week, that they're getting bigger regardless of how efficient they are. So you can either have them bigger and be efficient, or you can have them just be bigger. And that is pretty much the way it's going. So, and it has been going that way for a little while. We use the consumer, we're members in good standing of the Consumer Electronics Association, so we use their data. And they are getting bigger, but fortunately they're getting more efficient, thanks to, again, to a lot of investment here, faster than they're getting bigger.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Please.
The reason, there is a name for this, and what happens is that the person becomes accustomed to paying $20 a month for the electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than take solace or happiness in the fact that it suddenly drops by a dollar or something for the year, they simply buy a bigger set and still pay the $20. So I'm just saying, I'm looking for the efficiency, but I'm wondering if it's not being used up by virtue of more consumption.
Would you be talking about Jeevan's paradox?
Yes.
Oh.
Okay.
Geez. Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Now it all makes sense.
As I say, we're in the process of overcoming that, I think, because through a lot of hard work and a lot of investment on the part of the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance in our region, in our four-state region, we are doing our best to make them more efficient much faster than they are getting bigger. So I think, again, and that's one reason why there's no screen size limit on the standards here. We adopted British Columbia's version of the California standards because today we understand that the larger ones can actually meet the standards without any real trouble. But as they get bigger, if they're more efficient, the standards themselves, if you look at the standard, it's an equation. And it's based on, it's a wattage limit based on screen size. So as the screen size goes up, they're allowed to use more energy, but again, there's a maximum for any given screen size. So each, at any given screen size, they're going to be more efficient than they would have been.
It's an interesting line of questioning, Representative, and I would imagine perhaps there might be a couple of contextual points in that. One, there's, I guess, probably a theoretical upper bounds on, I mean, I would hope that there's a theoretical upper bounds on size of a television set, right, that it's not particularly, nobody's...
Have you looked at the billboards?
Well, as far as a home
interior
goes,
design.
So there's, yeah, exactly, so there might be perhaps a declining curve there, at least. And that I suppose it's probably that in returning value to a consumer on a given product, it is up to them to spend the addition to their budget in the way that maximizes their utility, and perhaps they are achieving utility maximization by a larger TV set may be the issue, but have the choice, I guess, where to spend that. Vice Chair Johnson, you want to add to this?
Well, yeah, I think following whatever that term was that Rep. Vance elicited from
our... Vance paradox?
There you go, the Vance paradox.
Vance paradox.
It seems to me... you know, to some degree, you know, you're fighting the marketplace, which, you know, i.e. the marketplace is always in about creating a better product and a more efficient product and a product that consumers want. And as Representative Benz is talking about, it's in, you know, a 19-inch color TV used to be $500. You can, for $500 now, you can get one that'll fill up your wall. So the idea that simply scaling back the energy requirements or performance of a given product doesn't mean that that's going to be the status quo in that household, because as their buying power increases or as this becomes more efficient, they're, like you say, they're going to buy the next size up, this one stays here, and so forth. So to some degree, I'm confused about why we're investing, I guess, so much time in this, because it seems like we're chasing something we're never going to quite get, because it keeps it keeps modifying, it keeps morphing. It's not a static situation. And, you know, efficiencies improve, consumer tastes improve. You know, we want more, better things and so forth. And I don't know if we're ever going to get there.
Well, this is what my organization does for a living. We invest in this cycle, and you're right, to a great extent. It's a cycle, and we invest to raise the efficiency of things. Then we come along and we try to get folks like you to raise the floor, and then we go through another cycle, because you're right, they're always inventing another product. What we're trying to do is make sure that when they do this and when they evolve the product into something that it isn't today, that it's more efficient than it would have been otherwise. It has a budget. It has an energy budget, because ultimately what we're really trying to do is keep your power rates down, because it's way cheaper for us to do this way than it is to build another power plant and run it. So this is the main reason why we engage in this at all, and why all of the electric utilities in the Pacific Northwest pay us to do this, because it's way cheaper for them to save a kilowatt hour than it is to generate another one. So about a quarter of the cost, really. So that's why we do it. And this is a piece of the cycle that's rather critical. And we'll go away for a while the folks invent and bring us the next round. And maybe we'll do another standard, and maybe we won't. I mean, I think the chair was correct. If there is a point at some point where we may have enough, and we may reach a plateau. In the case of televisions and battery chargers and these lamps today, that's not the case. We haven't gotten there yet, but we'd like to raise the floor so we can continue our work.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to come at this from a little different angle, more at the consumer angle, as the person who owns the 65-inch LED TV. And a 55-inch plasma TV, and they each provide different features and are better for viewing different programs. I'm just wondering, when we do this, where would the plasma? You've mentioned LED TVs, and we know that's where the industry is going to, and there isn't anything really more efficient than the LEDs that you can buy on the market. Plasma isn't quite as efficient, but I can tell you I don't get pixelation on my plasma that I do on my 65-inch LED TV. So, and having both TVs in the house, actually we have three different TVs in the house, but everybody sits down and watches a 65-inch television, and nobody watches the plasma anymore because we all have bad eyes, we need a bigger screen. So, are we really going to change the market, and can we hurt consumers who are watching sporting events who want that plasma television, because the plasma is not as efficient as the LED TV, but when it comes to watching sports, if you don't want any pixelation or anything like that, the plasma is actually a much nicer TV and better viewing angles when you get on the sides, as long as you don't get any sunlight coming in distorting the signal. So are we going to hurt consumers by doing something like this?
It doesn't appear that we will, because there are televisions like you described that are meeting the California standards, and therefore these standards today. They're listed on the CEC's website as meeting the standards. The standards that are being proposed are the equivalent of Energy Star 4.0. And in the Northwest, we're currently using Energy Star 6.0 plus 15%. We've gone well beyond that, but as you say, most of the ones that qualify at that level are the LED backlit ones, but plasmas still meet the standard. So it's not, we're not eliminating any technology that we're aware of. We're pretty sure that if it exists and certified in California, that it will be here too. So plasmas actually do better when you manage them better too, from an energy perspective. So they're there. I don't know how they'll do in the marketplace, but they're there.
And then if I may follow up on the chargers.
Please.
Just, and real quick on the chargers, since we have you here. Mm-hmm. Some of these chargers are designed, they have a little higher amp draw that they can put in so you can do fast charging with them. Are we going to affect that at all? So you'll pay a little bit more, because I know with the device that we sell, we actually have a unit that has a higher amp output on it, which uses more electricity, but it charges the battery much quicker than if you do the standard charger.
Right. Current battery chargers, before the standards, waste about 60% of the energy that they use. The standards are focused on about half of that waste, and the half that the standards are focused on is mostly the no battery and fully charged battery power consumption. They don't go after the waste that might be present in terms of rate of charge. So no, we won't be affecting rate of charge with the standards much at all. Mostly it's a matter of charge control and turning the charger off when the battery is full. That's really where the standards come in, and with no battery in the charger as well.
And if I may, one follow-up on that?
Quickly, we have three more panels to go as well.
A lot of people have iPhones with the little charger. Does it have a shut-off when the battery's full? Or are we going to affect everybody's iPhone?
No. There are over 4,000 products that are certified now on the California Energy Commission's list, and those chargers are among them. They'll be there. The cost of doing this ranges from, for a cell phone, about 35 cents to $1.10. It actually works, and Texas Instruments makes the silicon for it, and everybody's adopting it apparently because they're all certified as meeting the standards. So I think we're okay.
Present with it.
Okay, let's go to the kitchen, where some of us do most of our work. So will this, like on page 3, will this change the decrease the volumetric capacity of washing machines, for example? On page 3, they talk about it not exceeding, 4 feet in the case of a vertical axis, etc.
I'm not sure which.
Closed compartment, commercial clothes washer.
Sorry, Representative, are you looking at Senate Bill 692?
Yeah.
And you're looking at page three of the A and Gross bill. And if I'm understanding correctly, I believe you're looking at current law.
Okay, so will this change that? Okay, so nothing in the kitchen or the washing machine dryer?
No, battery chargers of various sizes, televisions, and some very high wattage quartz halogen incandescent lamps.
Great. That's okay, thank you.
Representative Dimbro?
I wanted to come back to Rep. Johnson's question, just looking at it from a, sort of the other side. What's the downside to our not passing this legislation?
We're in the process, I think, of influencing a new federal standard if the federal government ever gets around to doing a standard. The first thing they have to do is the test procedure, of course, which will help us enormously. It'll help everybody enormously. But California already has this standard as of the first of this year. British Columbia's standard, same standard, went into effect in January of 2012, and we're kind of aligning our market here on the West Coast to try to get all the same. We hope that when the federal government decides to do a standard, that they will adopt this one. And I think the more of us that do this, the more likely it is that that will happen.
Representative Reardon?
We're trying to set some policy here around this, and we all want more energy-efficient products. So I want to ask you, as the standards expert, which is more effective? Is it setting standards, or is it having more of an industry-based program, such as Energy Star, which you mentioned, which kind of incents industry, and it becomes competitive? Like when I bought my TV set, I really looked at the Energy Star labels. that motivated me as a consumer. I did not check for any underlying formula on power consumption. I just looked at, you know, $40 a year versus 80 or whatever. So could you talk a little bit about standards versus Energy Star?
Yeah, we utilize Energy Star at the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance every week. We're engaged with Energy Star to do that program, and the standards won't eliminate that. The standards will simply set a new floor below which televisions shouldn't be sold. But above that, there is lots of room for Energy Star and Energy Star specifications and programs, and we are the ones in the Pacific Northwest who invest most heavily in those programs for televisions. So, and we don't plan right now to stop.
Okay.
And I guess I would just follow up on that question and ask, given that there may be federal action coming on Energy Star 6.0, or higher. What is the advantage of having Oregon set a standard that meets the California standard?
Our biggest concern is what will happen when we actually find out how to measure television energy consumption properly. We're actually thinking that the numbers will go up. We're not basing our savings estimates on those higher numbers yet because we're not sure. But once we measure them properly, we think that the standard in most places or in many places would become more stringent, or it would appear to be more stringent. On the West Coast, though, and in the Pacific Northwest especially, we've invested heavily. Like I say, we're operating right now with a spec that is Energy Star 6.0 plus 15%. So we've pushed the marketplace in our part of the world high above that so that if we discover that the televisions aren't as efficient as we thought they were, we'll still be okay. We'll still have a program. We'll still have a way to help consumers find the most efficient television.
Thank you. Did you want to add to that, Mr. Bissonnette?
No, I just had a couple of quick things that I forgot to run through just in terms of changes that have been made that would take me about 15 seconds, but
please.
I'll do that at your convenience. I meant to do this in my opening remarks, but kind of got off track. Just so the committee has an idea of what we did in the Senate, there was a concern raised about battery chargers for exit lighting, or in the bill, egress lighting, that we addressed and exempted. There was a request from the Oregon Retail Council for a later implementation date for the plumbing fixtures, and that's why you see the January 2016 date in there for those. There was clarification that the National Electronic Manufacturers Association wanted for the outdoor light bulbs, which we did, and they they now have no problem with the bill. And so all of the issues, and then you'll hear more for better or for worse about the plumbing issues later. But all of the issues that were raised prior to a day or two before the work session, we were able to do. So those are the things that that were done in the Senate through the work group process that Senator Dingfelder addressed.
Thank you. I hope you gentlemen will stick around for the next panels. No.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
I'm sorry, I had a
little bird told you something.
That subsequent to that, there was a typo that was mentioned, or that was discovered, that we had caught one and missed the other one, and that is something we have yet to do here on behalf of Mr. Cravens and Tech America. And it was a it was simply a typo, literally changing a 5 to a 6 in one place and a 6 to a 5 in another place. And we are committed to doing that in the amendments we will bring forth.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Call up Jess. Every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings. Or a bell dies. And maybe, Jess Kincaid, Marty Stipe, and Brian Krieg, please.
Is that three bills?
Yes, you just don't know which ones. Is Brian here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There he is. And whoever would like to start?
Chair Bailey, co-chairs, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Jess Kincaid. I'm a policy analyst for Oregon Department of Energy, and with me is my colleague Marty Stipe, who's a facilities engineer for the department. We're here to provide a brief summary of the bill, and Marty will be providing a section-by-section analysis of the bill for you today. In the interest of your time, and because the senator and the previous speakers covered nearly all of my prepared testimony, I just wanted to make one brief point. The Pacific Coast Collaborative, which includes four western states and the province of Canada, have worked together to improve energy efficiency standards for certain products in the region. Senate Bill 692 aligns standards in Oregon with standards in California and in British Columbia in an effort to provide a regional standard that can help Oregon save both energy and their own energy costs. I'm happy to answer any questions, but again, in the interest of time, I'd like to ask Marty to begin his section-by-section analysis.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marty Stipe. I'm a facilities engineer with the Oregon Department of Energy. I'll go through the bill basically section by section. This bill proposes to add products to the Oregon's Appliance Standards Statute. Section 1 is involved with the definitions that were required for the televisions and battery chargers. We went through earlier and tried to align the verbiage in these definitions as closely as possible with California. And then Section 2 gets into additional definitions. Earlier you heard that there was an accommodation for implementation dates, and that's why we have the definitions in two sections. Excuse me, Section 2 is involved relates to the definitions with the plumbing fixtures and the electric lamp.
And I'm sure this is obvious, but just for the record, you're going through the sections of Senate Bill 692A.
Correct, Senate Bill 692A and gross.
Thank you.
Section 3 gets into the minimum efficiency standards, and this addresses the standards of operation and use for televisions as well as the battery chargers. Section 3 also addresses some of the implementation dates for the different types of battery chargers. There is a wide variety of battery chargers that we had to address and the different ways that they are brought into implementation based on how they're used. Some are used in repair and maintenance, and others are used for regional retail sale. Section 4 addresses the minimum efficiency standards for plumbing fixtures and the light bulbs. Slide through this. Section 5 and 6 address, I put them together, those two sections address the sale of these appliances and basically says that that in order to be offered for sale in Oregon, these appliances must comply with the energy efficiency standards in this statute. Section 7 and 8 address the same for the installation, is that in order to be installed, they have to comply with the energy efficiency standards in the statute. Section 9 is a miscellaneous section on relating to the unit captions for the convenience of the reader. Section 10 gets down to the implementation dates. It talks about the implementation date for televisions and most of the battery chargers would be upon the effective date of the bill. The implementation date for the plumbing fixtures and electric light bulbs would be become effective January 1st. So, in effect, the sections of this bill are 1, 3, 5, and 7 are for one group of appliances, 2, 4, 6, and 8 are for the other two pieces of appliances.
Thank you. Why don't we take questions for the department now? Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, does the department look into the consequences to those retailers who have this type of stuff on their shelves that is basically not meeting these standards 2 years out? And in other words, how do we know the impact of this legislation on all the folks out there that are subject to these standards?
Chair Bailey, Representative Bence, when the work groups were held, we had people in attendance who were asking for those considerations, and if I'm not mistaken, those were taken into consideration when the dates, effective dates, were set in this proposed bill.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Please.
For my purposes, of course, I need a little more certainty than your answer provided. So, if you're not mistaken, how can we get to for sure? In other words, you said, if I'm not mistaken, does that mean for sure, or do we need to wait for data showing that indeed this isn't going to cost a bunch of people a fortune because of this change in standards?
I don't think I'm able to assure that the sellers of these devices, you know, what is on the shelf. I believe that the way this bill is written, and we could ask Mr. Stevens, but this is related to the manufacturer date of the equipment, and then once it's on the shelf, they can sell this.
Mr. Stevens, did you want to comment on this?
Charlie Stevens. I think the more important thing about most of these products is that they are, first of all, in our region, they are the standard. They're pretty much well beyond the standard. I would be surprised in our region if you could actually find any products that don't meet the standard right now based on the way we understand television energy use, for instance, to be measured. But I don't think that you'll find there's enough. The reason why we have an effective date that's months or sometimes years in advance is to accommodate the special needs of the way that retail distribution chain works. By the time the 2014 models of these things come out, I can't quite guarantee you this, but I would, because I don't know how to measure the energy use of televisions yet, but we'll have to measure it USDOE's way before the end of the year.
And is it
correct? There won't be any that don't meet the standard, I hope.
And is it correct to say that this issue, and especially the issue of dates and cost to retailers, came up in the work group and that was addressed through the amendments on the Senate side?
Yes, it was. And again, we work directly with the retailers who sell 90% of the televisions in the Pacific Northwest. So we actually have their assurance that these standards are fine. We have the assurance of the manufacturers that these standards are fine, like the vice president of Vizio, who would be okay if the standards were more stringent. But again, we don't know how to measure that yet.
Further questions for the department?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, of course, the bill applies to far more than televisions, and so it would be interesting to make sure that this bill doesn't negatively impact battery chargers and the other things that are caught up in this bill any differently than that which we just heard about televisions. But it does lead. But the response does lead to a question about the impact this legislation has upon those who do sell into this market. And so, does the department have an idea, or can it share with us whether these higher standards in any way narrow the group of folks that sell to Oregon or sell into Oregon?
I don't have that information at this time. We can look into that for you if you wish.
Thank you.
Representative Whiting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Vince was kind of hitting on the issue that I have, and it's more with the chargers, because when you get in the industrial environment, and some of this will go into consumer environment for multimeters, for some of these handheld computer devices, these are designed with a 7 to 10 year life span. And sometimes you have product that's out there that's 10, 15 years old, and I'm still making chargers for that product. Am I now going to be violating the law building a replacement charger for a product that's out in the field already?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whiter, those devices are currently exempt, and there is the last part of the bill actually addresses the date. It pushes those out to 2017.
But 2017, the device was made well before that, and I'm getting a replacement charger in 2020 for it. Will I still be able to sell that charger to that customer? Their charger blew up. They need a new charger. But the charger is not going to meet the standard.
Mr. Stevens, do you have an...
I think he has the answer to that.
Maybe you could swap that with him here.
Take up.
Charlie Stevens again. This is an interplay between federal standards and state standards, and ultimately, as I mentioned earlier, the federal standards are in abeyance right now with an RFI, a request for information out on state standards for battery chargers, and we expect that as soon as they learn what products are out there, they will complete the federal standards. Once that happens, it will be illegal to manufacture or import a battery charger that does not meet those standards, the standards that we're setting today. We hope, if we if we're persuasive at the federal level. And once that happens, I doubt seriously that you would be able to find in 2018 a charger that was manufactured contrary to the standards, even as a replacement charger, especially for the smaller ones. And you could probably buy, the reason for that is because inventory costs money. And no one keeps a huge inventory of any of these replacement chargers. They actually will make a year's worth at most and keep them handy. So once the standard is known, and the standard for replacement chargers does not become effective until 2017, which is long after the first sale chargers goes into effect, I would really challenge you to be able to find a charger by that time that didn't meet the standard.
May follow up. And the is this just going to be consumer taking industrial devices? Because I actually have a data collector that's 15 years old. I rebuild the batteries for that. The charger, they still manufacture the components for that. That charger, I know, is not legal under these standards.
But so if you were to get a new charger, it probably would be.
It's a proprietary battery charger. That's something that happens in the industrial environment. You make weird shaped batteries that only work for that device. So they have to go back and buy the charger from you.
Right. I think the manufacturer of the charger, though, if you trace it back, may actually be a third party. And they manufacture to the seller of your system that you're describing. And I think you'll find that you might have to wait for a charger of that type, and they would make it for you, but they would make it under the new standards.
Mr. Krieg, would you like to get some testimony in here?
Thank you, Chair Bailey. For the record, my name is Brian Krieg, and today I'm here representing the Plumbing Mechanical Contractors Association, but also the Plumbing Manufacturers International. The latter group you're probably not familiar with, but PMI represents the companies that sell 90% of the plumbing fixtures in the United States. That includes Kohler, Toto, all of the brands that you're familiar with out in the store, and even many brands you're not familiar with. I'm going to talk a little bit about 692 to begin with and then move into 840 if that is okay with the chair.
Yeah.
In working with the group as the first legislation came out on 692, we put plumbing standards and information into this bill, and it was in a different section of the statutes than is normally this kind of information would be in the plumbing code. And after discussion, it was decided that it would be better for all to have the plumbing information where people look for it, and that being in the plumbing code, and that there already were standards there that just needed basically updated is all we need to do is work on some of the numbers on it that had become out of date. So in 692 and the amendments that will be coming, you will be seeing that we would be striking out the plumbing language in there. That is language like on page 27 that's in bold and continues on to the top of section of page 28, and then further down on 28, section 6, there's some bold language there, and then section 8, the bold language there. All the stuff about toilets and all would come out of 692. Representative Widener asked the question of couldn't we squish this all back into the bill. This is the problem, actually, is the relating clause, and then trying to make the plumbing language accessible to those when they're looking for plumbing information and putting in a plumbing code makes sense, and so we can't do that with the relating clause of 692. It's just not wide enough, just that little bit.
I asked to keep them separate for the senator's preference, just to be clear.
Okay.
Together was not good for her.
So moving on to Senate Bill 840, I have provided you some electronic testimony. There's a letter, hopefully, you have seen and gotten here. And if we look at some of the key points that I mentioned there, and I will point out then in a couple of places in the bill, many of you had questions regarding this. And I'd say our industry is supportive of this measure, mainly because the plumbing manufacturers are all moving to this standard. And the standards in these numbers that are in front of you today are what they want. they're not too far out in advance. It is what they're going to be manufacturing the bulk of the product to in the future. So we're really just keeping pace with where it is already going from the standpoint of the items that you would be able to buy either at the retail or at wholesale as a plumber. The standards existed in the plumbing code, so as I said, we're just updating them. We worked with the industry groups to tack out the numbers on here. So one thing we do not want is equipment that does not work. In the early days of the low flush toilets, well, we had a lot of failures out there, and just nobody wants their toilet to fail. It's not a good thing. So these are numbers that will work. The equipment will work if it is installed correctly. On that. The third item is putting the dates for getting, flushing out the stock that is there. Once again, we don't
Emma
store.
Emma used to build eyes.
I will stay away from it. The issue is, yes, we will work through the stock in this time frame. And once again, the new stock that we're going to be getting is going to be manufactured to this these standards, regardless of whether we would want them to older standards or not. And the plumbing code is also going to be coming up for review in a couple of years, and we will be seeing new standards coming from it that will all mesh with this. And so we've pushed those dates out so that everything is in sync, and that's some of the things that we did in the Senate side. Lastly, one of the key items that was very important for me in my industry was there are situations where that low-flow toilet might not work right. Mm-hmm. Need to have a safety valve out there so that there's a way to do that. And interestingly enough, if you go into SB 840 and on the first page, if you look down to line number 20, there's a notwithstanding clause there. And it gives then, after that, quite a few examples of where the building official can waive the requirement. The situation Representative Boone has is probably a good example of that. Other places are that we need to make sure that we have a little different equipment, say like in our prisons. They have a very different situation. A historic building where we might be wanting to manufacture something or remanufacture something that fits in that. So what we do have is the building officials have some ability to grant an exemption when it is needed on that. And that's, I think, one of the most important things that we've had in the code. We've always had that, and we'd be able to apply that. So I think with we enjoyed the opportunity of working with many of the groups on this and the plumbing manufacturers and also the plumbing mechanical contractors support SB 840. We're just moving ahead.
Representative Whitsitt.
Mostly it's for the chair. On SB 840, would you look at page 2, lines 9 through 11, and tell me what your interpretation of that is?
I would be happy to look at that, but do we have an interpretation from the panel here?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, what you're seeing is we're starting to change some language. In the mid-90s, actually changed and put in some of the standards that were in place to move forward flow rates, reducing them in the toilets at that time. And so what we're doing here is adjusting the numbers on that, and it really does relate to the sale of new products, and that was one of your earlier questions, and I did mean to address that. So this does just affect. If you're taking a toilet out and you're going to resell it after it's been used on it, the law does not trip us up on that.
Is that written to say that? I read
yes.
It. A person may not sell or offer for sale any used water closet, urinal, shower head, or inferior faucet that does not meet the conservation standards. And again, I'm concerned about the reuse stores and the Habitat for Humanity stores that when you remodel a house, you can take your appliances in and donate them, and then they resell them or use them. And I just want to make sure that, how do you read that?
Well, Representative, and we can get follow up on this. My understanding of these lines is that it does not change current law substantively, and that the deleted references refer to a date in the past that would have been in effect at that time in the previous statute anyway. This may be a cleanup of that statute, but we can get back to you on that interpretation.
Chair Bailey, that is the interpretation. It just takes out that date.
That is a cleanup of the statute as opposed to a change in the functionality of the statute.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I have to ask, because I'm just dying of curiosity. Definitions of urinal and water closet in Senate Bill 692, why do neither of those mean fixtures designed for installation in prisons or other penal institutions?
Chair Bailey, there are some issues there that they're going to use maybe a little higher flow rates there to make sure that we don't have stoppages.
Enough said. Thank you. Okay.
They can't plug them up on purpose.
I had to ask. Any other questions for this panel? Representative Reardon.
Just for my own education, but we've already said that industry is, Brian said that industry is already using these standards, and we're also in code, so why are we doing anything at all?
Representative Bailey, Representative Reardon, the numbers that we have in code are old ones, and to a certain degree, just updating them to where we're going to be at with the new ones is useful so that we don't end up with a situation of some odd products starting to be dumped on us, I would say, is one of the issues on it. We've, as I say, in the past, we've had the standards there. So this is just moving to where catching it back up with the industry.
Keeping
the manufacturing.
So keeping the floor moving up, as it were.
Yes.
So this is driving the coding. This is the head of the code.
Chair Bailey, Representative Reardon, yes, slightly ahead of the code, but they're already working on the next round of the codes. Codes for the plumbing code and electrical and others are on a 3-year cycle, so that's already being worked on right now, where we adopt it through. We're always, the actual code books to some degree are always a little bit behind.
Okay. We're going to need to move on to get through the rest of the witnesses here. So thank you very much for this panel. Appreciate it. Call up Holly Evans, please, Mark Yeager, and Michael Reed. Ms. Evans, please.
I assume I go first?
Please.
Good afternoon. My name is Holly Evans, and I'll be representing the Consumer Electronics Association today, and it's wonderful that we have a member in the room. Charlie Stevens, welcome. I'm going to be taking a little different approach than Charlie to the regulation of televisions under the bill, SB 692. The Consumer Electronics Association is the trade association that represents the U.S. consumer electronics industry, and we are supporting an amendment that is currently being drafted that would replace the bill's regulatory provisions that pertain to televisions with a replace that those provisions with a state procurement requirement that would require Oregon agencies to purchase Energy Star televisions. And not only would this amendment foster the development and deployment in Oregon of the most energy-efficient televisions that are on the market, but it would also avoid the undesired effect of establishing unnecessary state-specific energy efficiency standards for televisions that could harm innovation, impede competition, and reduce consumer choice. And just the interesting thing about going on the last panel is I could address a few of the comments that were made earlier. And I've heard a lot about the dumping argument, and I heard from Charlie that this may not even apply to televisions, because televisions that are being sold in Oregon right now really do meet the California energy efficiency requirements. So that's one issue I wanted to point out. Another comment about the spare parts for battery chargers. I'm aware of certain consumer electronics that have spare parts that are supplied 15 to 17 years after the product is deployed, because they are high-performing products. So just because a product is a consumer electronic does not mean that it has a cheap battery charger. A lot of these products are very technical and require very sophisticated battery chargers. I'm going to talk a little bit about Energy Star. Energy Star, since 1991, the Consumer Electronics Association has been a partner with the U.S. Department of Energy and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency on Energy Star. And Energy Star was a program that really was designed to work with the consumer electronics industry. Consumer electronics are unique in that they are innovative, they have rapid time-to-market cycles, and they really represent unique products that every life cycle are usually more efficient than the previous life cycle. That's a very unique thing in our economy. And so the Energy Star program was designed to work with electronic producers and really set these energy efficiency specifications at the top 25% of the market, representing best-in-class standards. And what these electronic producers do is they really compete to get their products to that 25%. And once they achieve that 25%, a lot more products meet it, and so EPA goes in and sets it at a higher level. And it's almost like a race to the top. Unlike a race to the bottom, the consumer electronics industry enjoys this race to the top. Energy Star is particularly well-suited for the consumer electronics industry, which is characterized by innovation and a pattern of improved energy efficiency. And I'd like to talk about the example of a laptop battery. The efficiency of a laptop battery, your laptop, right now I've been running on about 7 hours here. A few years ago, I may have only gotten 4 hours. And that's being driven not by regulation. It's being driven by consumer preference. Consumers want laptops that run on a longer battery. And I would argue consumers are driving energy efficiency in the consumer electronics industry. Some examples of this, the latest televisions are among the most energy efficient products in the home today. From 2003 to 2010, on-mode power consumption for LCD televisions decreased 63%, and standby mode power consumption decreased 87%. During the same period, on-mode power consumption for plasma TVs dropped 41%, and standby mode power consumption dropped 85%. So these are significant drops that are occurring without federal regulation, without significant state regulation. And we're not aware of any household appliances or equipment categories that come close to these efficiency gains. Energy Star is a dynamic product, Energy Star is a dynamic program that produces frequent product specification revisions. In the last 3 years, the Energy Star specification has been revised 3 times, and each time it becomes more stringent, encouraging competition in this race toward the top. Just by way of contrast, the California Energy Commission efficiency rules operate very differently. They establish a floor, and if your product cannot meet that floor, your product cannot be sold in California. And although that looks great on the surface, it does ignore the fact that in the consumer electronics industry, there are innovations that are occurring that, for example, I always provide the example of a multifunction device. You're all familiar with a multifunction device. You have a scanner, a printer, and a copy. Are all in one unit. 10 years ago, you'd have separate devices in your office that would achieve each of those functions, but by combining those functions, you now have a product that is innovative. It may use incrementally a little bit more energy, but if there were an energy efficiency standard in the marketplace, that innovation may not have happened. So a lot of these regulations on their face could prevent future innovations from even being developed. The other thing, the California energy rules are currently on the books, and the entire television industry designs to these standards. They are now global standards. So as the previous testifier mentioned, currently in the Oregon market, these products already meet the California energy requirements. So we would argue, why does Oregon need to establish additional requirements? You may say, why does it matter? The requirements are already on the books. Why does the consumer electronics industry care? But every time that a state establishes a specific regulation, it could add its own vanilla flavoring to add a little tweak to it. In fact, we talked about the typo that's in the Senate-passed version of the bill. Those little typos, once they become law, then require time to come back and have to argue why they need to be changed. So the more that states try to mimic what's already on the books, although it seems not to be of significant impact, little changes can really affect the market, especially when when companies are designing to the global marketplace.
And unfortunately, we are starting to run out of time, so if you could wrap up your comments.
So, in conclusion, we really encourage the committee to adopt a legislation that builds on the forward model of Energy Star. Energy Star works very well for the consumer electronics industry. It promotes innovation. It promotes new products that could replace old inefficient products, and we would encourage you to accept the amendment that's currently being drafted.
Thank you. Gentlemen.
I'm actually going to go next. Okay. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Mark Yeager. I'm the utility services manager for the City of Albany. I'm going to talk about the plumbing part of Senate Bill 692 and 840. So first I'd like to say we would support the amendment that is supposed to be drafted to take the plumbing language out of 692. So want to be on the record with that. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of Clean Water Agencies and the League of Oregon Cities, organizations that are responsible for operating and maintaining wastewater systems in Oregon. Some of us also wear the water supplier hat, so we understand the need and the importance of water conservation measures. However, the proposed standards, these are the plumbing standards in 840, may have some unintended consequences, and from a sewer operator's perspective, we have some concerns about Senate Bill 840. Reduced water consumption through water conservation measures will ultimately result in less flow to the wastewater collection system. Our sewer systems were built 30 to 50 years ago or longer, and they were not designed to operate effectively under low flow conditions. Reduced flows will eventually increase the risk of interruption from blockages. They may cause odor problems, may result in premature pipeline failures. Responding to these issues will increase the need for maintenance activities through flushing. And that's sort of counterintuitive to the prospect of conserving water, because we're going to have to put water into the system in order to keep the solids moving in the wastewater system. It will require changes to design standards and plumbing codes and increase capital expenditures for repairs and replacements. We have scheduled a conference call with the proponents of the legislation for tomorrow, as you have already heard, to discuss our concerns and possible alternative pathways for the legislation. Committee staff is also slated to participate in the call. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today, and I'm available to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Sir.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Michael Reed. I'm the general manager of the Oak Lodge Sanitary District. I'm here representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I'm also a former president of the Water Environment Federation, which is an international organization which is dedicated to water quality and conservation. And in some ways, you know, when you fill out the little sheet to testify, having to check that box in opposition was very hard for me to do, because I'm an advocate for water conservation and conservation of all our natural resources. However, I'm here to expound a little bit on some of the comments that Mark made. Sanitary sewer systems have a vehicle for moving waste, so that's water, and particularly in areas which have low slope to their sewers, the lack of water ends up causing deposition of solids in the sewers, and ultimately that creates an environment which literally destroys the sewer from the inside. You form acids where the material biodegrades within the sewer, and those acids eat the bottom of the pipe. You have accumulation of hydrogen sulfide gases in the sewer, which form sulfuric acid, which eats the pipe at the top, and you get odors out of the systems. We advocate for water conservation measures. We do have a concern, though, that of the unintended consequences that potentially can come from adopting a standard, which there are war stories coming out of California already about some of the problems they're having with odor and corrosion within their systems because of this good intended effort to find ways to make our limited water supplies go further. The water is needed to transport wastes. Our systems mostly work on gravity, but it is the water that makes it work and gets it there. And we are working, as Mark mentioned, with the proponents of this bill to see if there are ways to address our concerns. But the costs long term of having a system which would cause corrosion within the billions of dollars of infrastructure that are buried in the ground to transport wastewater are untold millions and billions of dollars. And we just want to make sure that as we move forward with these good intended efforts to conserve water, that we don't create another problem that we're back looking for funding later on to put on the ratepayers' backs to now replace sewer systems which have been decomposing because of this effort. Thank you.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate both of you being here because I was hoping we'd have someone representing the public works portion of this because it's not just simply about flushing, it's about where does that go and how does it get to where its ultimate destination is. And I think what you're referring to is, I think, you know, within the industry, you go by grade and so forth, you know, eighth of an inch per foot or whatever is usually adequate, I know, within wastes within a house to move the stuff out, but you're relying upon a certain volume of water to move that waste at that grade. So what you're saying is that within your municipalities and so forth, we have miles and miles and miles of, you know, sanitary sewer pipe that's graded at a certain level, relying upon a certain amount of water volume to move that solid. And if we don't have that, there will be problems. Do we have data? You're talking about California. Are there specific circumstances within municipal systems where if we can point to evidence of this happening?
I don't have specific.
I don't need to have it now, but if you could find
it. I don't have specific data, but I did read some articles about San Francisco's experience where they've had particularly odor problems, and Sacramento had odor problems. In San Francisco, the article I read said they were spending $15 million or $14 million for bleach over 3 years to flush the system to control the odors. And I think one of the concerns that we would have, forgetting the odor issue, which is, of course, an issue for the community, is the fact that the only way we as a utility have the ability to move the solids which deposit in the sewer is to put more water in the sewer. So you reduce the amount of water coming out of the homes. It creates a problem where now we have deposition. Now we're either opening hydrants or getting tanker mm-hmm. trucks and going up to the end of the system and dumping extra water down the system to flush it out. So it doesn't really get you the savings that you're looking for water consumption reductions. Another issue, too, is that we're under a lot of pressure as agencies today to not have sanitary sewer overflows. They create health problems, they create water quality problems and environmental problems, and when you have deposition in the sewer, you end up having plugging, and then you have overflows out of manholes which go into the waters of the state or into private homes or the community, and that's another thing that by not having adequate flushing in the sewer system, there would be likely an increase in the frequency of sanitary sewer overflows.
Thank you. Additional questions? Representative Dembro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the television issue, if I could. So, again, if you could summarize what the downside is to this legislation, you know, given that, you know, what will be harmed by passing this legislation? I know you feel that it's unnecessary, but what is the downside to it?
Well, the downside is... the industry has prided itself on working with the regulatory agencies since 1991 on Energy Star, and it's been a successful model in helping the promoting the most energy-efficient products on the market. The downsides of adopting the California Energy Commission regulation in the state is it creates uncertainty on the regulated community because, as we talked earlier, we talked about the issue between the agency adopting the rule or the legislation drafting the rule, and there's this uncertainty about what the language says. And if the language doesn't get it right, then there are two sets of rules.
Right, but if I could come back, is there anything specifically in this language of this bill that's going to be a problem?
No. In fact, the industry is already doing it. I think that's one thing we would both agree. The industry is doing it. The industry are meeting the requirements. And we would say, why invest time and energy in establishing requirements in Oregon when the limits are already being met? It's only creating another administrative role for your energy agency. And if there's no public policy need, I would argue that's almost not a good investment of the resources of this body to establish rules that aren't necessary if the objective of the rules are already being met through the California rules.
Okay, but you don't see anything in this that would be harmful to your industry at all?
No, because we have been working to make sure the limits are exactly word for word exact. But if another state decides to go this way, and they do not pay as much attention to the language, and all of a sudden they use, instead of date of manufacture, they use date of sale, that creates compliance uncertainty. And it is a precedential thing, and we do view Energy Star as the best way to promote energy efficiency in the industry because it rewards best in class as opposed to prohibiting the worst that's out there. We think it's a better public policy agenda.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for this panel. No, appreciate it. And finally, Wendy Gerlitz, please, and Joel Fisher. Wendy?
Thank you, Chairman Bailey, and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. For the record, my name is Wendy Gerlitz. I work with the Northwest Energy Coalition. We are a regional organization that is a coalition of utilities, environmental organizations, energy businesses, and low-income and consumer advocacy organizations working to promote clean and affordable energy throughout the Pacific Northwest. I'm the Oregon Policy Associate, and so I'm happy to be here in support of Senate Bill 692A. We are supporting this bill because we believe that this bill protects the interests of Oregonians by adding the next generation of low-cost and high-benefit measures to Oregon's existing standards. You've heard a lot today about what this bill will do, and we believe that this bill really does prevent Oregon from being a dumping ground for appliances that are outdated and that are, frankly, no better than a similarly or exactly the same cost appliance that can save the consumers energy and money. I want to close. I'm just going to be short today because you've heard a lot already. But I wanted to close by summarizing some of the savings figures that Senator Dingfelder was quoting to you earlier. And that is that the annual bill savings for Oregonians as a result of these standards in the year 2020 will be over $25 million in annual savings. And for that adds up to a cumulative savings over the life of these appliances of about $168 million. So those are some serious economic benefits to the state from the inaction of this legislation, and we hope that you will consider that when you are considering the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gerlitz.
Mr. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher with the Oregon Business Association. OBA strongly supports the goal of increasing energy efficiency in ways that strengthen our economy, are economically efficient, and make additional capital available for the Oregon economy. OBA supports common sense energy efficiency programs as a cost-effective way of generating new energy. Adopting minimum energy efficiency standards for small appliances similar to what's been already adopted in California will be an economic boon to Oregon energy and water consumers, from families and schools to businesses and public buildings. Senate Bill 692 and 840 is legislation necessary to build on and refine our system that's already effectively delivering efficiencies, and we urge your support.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've heard a couple times from folks fearful that Oregon's going to become a dumping ground for these appliances if we don't adopt these, but why Oregon? Why not Idaho or Montana or some far less sophisticated state than us? I think we're a pretty sophisticated consumer base here. Does anybody have any data on that, or is it just kind of talking points that kind of gets woven into the narrative?
Well, I'm assuming you're directing that to me. I think the fear is that if you don't have the standards in place, I mean, we've heard today, well, we're all already doing this and everybody's already doing this, but if you don't have the standards in place, what about the manufacturers that aren't doing it, that aren't represented here today, and where are they going to sell their products? And if they can, you know, I don't know, have all the ins and outs of the regional distribution systems for these appliances, but my guess would be, you know, if California has these standards in place, they can't go to California, and so if they've got some on the West Coast, where are they going to go? They're going to go to the place that doesn't have the standards in place and where it's legal to sell them. And so I think it just, you know, if we're already doing this anyway, then passing this also has no downside to it. But not passing it could have the downside of not protecting the interests of Oregonians. You know, in my mind, that's the way I look at it. So,
Mr. Stevens, did you want to get in on this?
Yeah.
I'll add, Charlie Stevens, I'll add one place where I do have data.
In fact,
I actually had
bit.
These conversations with the HVAC industry when we were doing heating and air conditioning standards. And I said, what'll happen to the stuff that you would ordinarily be selling here when it's no longer legal? And he said, this had to do with furnaces mostly. But he said, Utah, Nevada. He said, our stuff mostly comes out of California, like just about everybody else's products that are distributed. They're distributed out of warehouses in California for the West Coast. And so where are the closest places to California that don't have standards? Well, they're the states that are right on the border of California. Oregon, Nevada, Utah, so and Arizona. So that's where most of the stuff goes, based from the HVAC industry's standpoint, and I suspect the same would be true of other products.
Well, and I can't speak to the HVAC situation, but I think if you look at the marketplace, everybody wants the most efficient car you can get. We buy those. We pay extra for it sometimes. Look at the Prius market. We've heard about the battery life on laptops. You know, consumers want that. So all I'm saying is I don't think it necessarily is a valid argument that Oregon would become the dumping ground for all of the California's excess products. So that's all I wanted to say.
Okay. And I might imagine that California might have sufficient products to dump on a lot of folks.
Right, exactly. Take them to Oklahoma. Yeah.
I believe we're 3% of the market. We're just a big player out there.
That's right. Seeing nothing further, thank you all for your testimony. We appreciate it. And is there anybody else who'd like to be heard on Senate Bill 692 or Senate Bill 840? Seeing none, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 692. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 840. Anything else for the good of the order?
We're
stopping. It is adjourned.